We're spending the hour on pocketbook issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What is the right approach to managing credit cards during the pandemic? One positive bit of news is that Americans are doing a good job of paying down credit card bills during COVID. According to the New York Federal Reserve, credit card holders paid down $82 billion in card debt in the second quarter of this year. And this decline in balances hasn't been seen in at least 20 years. Are you concerned about whether you can pay the minimum payment on your card? Are you transferring a balance or trying to pay off a card? Bring your situation, your tips on cards, 800-642-1234. Aaron Lowry is a personal finance expert and author of Broke Millennials, Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Life Together. Aaron, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Great to be back.
Well, let's start with credit card hardship programs. What is the status of these hardship programs that credit card companies offer that are supposed to provide immediate relief to their customers dealing with a financial crisis?
Well, the good news is they certainly do still exist. What is, and it's not bad news, but a little bit more complicated, is they're not necessarily well advertised. So it's not necessarily that you can log on and see at the top, oh, hardship program, and enroll yourself. Generally, you do need to actually call up, make contact. There are a couple of issuers that might make it a bit simpler, but you are probably going to have to discuss this with a representative on the phone in order to get enrolled.
When companies look at these programs, what might they be forgiving as part of the program?
Well, in most cases, it's not that they're going to absolve you of your debt, but they're going to help you put you on a repayment plan that's a bit more palatable for your current situation. So if you've been furloughed or had a significant pay cut or face unemployment, serious illness, family emergency, these are all issues that could qualify you for a hardship program. The other thing to consider is they're not necessarily just going to take you at your word. You might actually need to provide them with documentation of your hardship in order to get enrolled.
And in terms of forgiving late fees or freezing your interest rates, could that be part of the program?
It certainly can be. And one of the things that you need to consider is don't just necessarily accept the first offer. You need to have a realistic conversation about what you can actually afford. If they say, oh, we're going to waive the most recent late fee, but can you keep paying normally at your, let's say, 24% APR? And if that's not doable for you, then you need to be honest about it. In some cases, they might say, okay, we're going to give you 0% interest rate for the next 6 months. And that's going to enable you to really attack that principal balance that you owe and possibly even make up for late payments that possibly have accrued in this time.
And to me, credit card companies, they would want our business long term. Isn't it in their best interest to work with their customers experiencing an unforeseen financial emergency?
It generally is in their best interest. And the other thing, again, and I know so much pride and ego can be wrapped up in these conversations, and that can make it hard for us to be proactive about reaching out. But, and I know I said it last time I was on, this is not a situation where we want to ask for forgiveness rather than permission. We want to inverse that common saying, and we want to be asking for permission first. So before you miss that payment, you want to be calling up, especially if you have a really good track record as a customer of making your on-time payments. They are likely to work with you, and hey, they want money, even if it's just some of the money, they want their money.
What if you're afraid of having a difficult conversation with a credit card issuer? I mean, how much leverage do customers have?
The leverage conversation can be a little bit awkward because ultimately they do have a lot of the power. But again, they do want their money. So even if it's you calling up and saying, I've been furloughed, this is the realistic information on my current budget, I can only afford to pay half of the minimum payment that you're asking, what can we do? And giving them some sort of solution and seeing if they'll problem solve with you can be really helpful.
We're talking with Aaron Lowry. She is a personal finance expert, author of Broke Millennial. We're diving into credit cards, other pocketbook issues, and you can join in. What financial challenges is your family facing due to the pandemic? Have you been laid off or furloughed? Is your family struggling to keep up with bills or redo the budget from ground up? What questions do you have about credit cards, savings, or philanthropy at this time? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Erin, you know, there's a statistic that about two-thirds of Americans are concerned whether they can even pay the minimum payment on their card debt right now and in the coming months. Is it worth paying below the minimum payment, even if you have some money to put together for it?
I wouldn't make that move without first having a conversation with your credit card company and trying to get either enrolled in a hardship program or negotiate a new minimum monthly payment. Because if you don't hit your minimum, then that doesn't really count in their eyes as making your payment, and it could ultimately adversely affect your credit score. So be sure to call up and have that conversation first.
Sarah called from Duluth, Minnesota, couldn't stay with us, and she says that she bought a car a year ago after leasing it and has been ahead on payments. But for some reason, payments have risen about $40, and Sarah's unsure if this is due to COVID and wants to know, how do you handle this situation? Is negotiation possible on car payments? And Sarah adds, car payments are already so high.
Well, I would look and see if it's possible that you might have a variable interest rate, and that's perhaps why it increased, if for some reason the interest rate on your loan went up. And also give them a call. You have your records of making those payments and making more than the minimum due, it sounds like, and have a conversation with, hey, why did you increase it by $40 a month? I've been a good customer. I've always been paying proactively. So what's happening here?
Yeah, so really keeping those communication lines open, super important, regardless of what kind of debt it is.
Absolutely. And again, having proof that you have been consistent, that you have made all of these on-time payments and paying more than what is due really does work in your favor.
Let's look at student debt right now. You know, student loans are so problematic, but federal loans are in a bit of a hiatus, if you will, with the payment freeze at the federal level. What can you say about students? Because, you know, some have decided to take a gap year instead of doing the all virtual college classes. What financial impact might they be feeling right now?
Across the board, student loans are just incredibly difficult to be dealing with. It is good news that there is a deferment until right now, January of 2021. And I would say, too, for everybody out there, and I'm kind of focused more on probably those who have already graduated or perhaps taking time off of school, it can be tempting to keep making those payments if you have the financial flexibility to do so, but I would actually encourage you to shore up your cash reserves right now, because we don't know what's coming down the pike. We're not quite sure what the job market or anything else is going to look like in the next 5 or 6 months. So really consider, instead of making payments right now, putting that money into an emergency fund. I call the unicorns the people who should be making the payments. If you're gainfully employed, very little risk of being furloughed or losing your job, have a fully funded emergency fund, then sure, aggressively pay off your student loans right now while we're in deferment. But otherwise, really consider focusing on cash.
When the deferment is over for these federal loans, what might January hold? I mean, what will repayments, they will restart, as we know, resume at the beginning of the year. What might that look like?
And this is, again, a situation where you need to look at what the terms of your repayment program is and be realistic with yourself about whether or not you can make those monthly minimum payments. And if you can't, I would get a hold of your servicer as early as possible, because those phone lines are going to be tied up come January, because a lot of people will be calling in to have conversations.
Erin Lowry is author of Broke Millennial and a personal finance expert. Are you a student carrying education debt? What is the fall semester like for you financially? Could you keep your on-campus job amid COVID? Have you decided to take a gap year? What questions do you have about what a gap in schooling could mean for your financial situation, your loans? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Erin Lowry right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour on money issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the summer, graduates of the class of 2020, they transitioned into their working lives in these unprecedented times. Meanwhile, rising college seniors face the worst job market in modern history. According to WalletHub, 2/3 of college students say this crisis has changed how they feel about their financial future. Are you dealing with student loan debt? How long ago did you graduate college? Do you have federal loans? Are you taking an interest-free pause? Do you know what happens to your repayment plan next year? It's 800-642-1234. Your money questions, your situations, front and center. Personal finance author Aaron Lowry is our guide. Aaron, you mentioned that emergency fund, and certainly the first step is the first dollar to opening up that emergency fund. How do we get started with it?
I know it sounds like such an overwhelming proposition, especially right now, but you're right. The first dollar, the really big way that you need to start, though, is figuring out exactly how much you need. The rule of thumb that you likely hear is 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses. Or if you're paying down debt, I would advise at least 1 month's worth of living expenses set aside in emergency savings. But sometimes when we hear a month, that sounds like so much money. And this is when I encourage people to know what I call the bare essential budget. What is the bare minimum you need to make it through in a month? Making that mortgage or rent payment, food on the table, utilities paid, healthcare, transportation, all of the basics. That's your number, not at your current or at a more, you know, let's say luxurious lifestyle. It's just bare bones. And having that number can make you feel a little bit better about, okay, that's more attainable. I can do this.
Yeah, so really kind of stripping out the extras in our life, but that's also really hard to do because those extra things can seem to get really buried into statements or on plans where you pay a little bit each month. So how should we dissect our budget so that we know where these hidden expenses are?
Well, first I would sit down and actually write it all out. Write down how much do I pay for housing? What is my average cost of utilities? And in that case, I would pull statements from different seasons and make sure seasonally, you know, like in the summer, it might be a lot lower than in the winter when I'm paying for heat. And keep going all the way down and thinking about all of these bare essentials, healthcare, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and perhaps childcare as well. And then that's your total number at the bottom. I always like to add a $100 buffer because inevitably the first or second time we do this exercise, we kind of forget something. And it's always nice to have a little bit of a buffer in there.
We're discussing family finances this hour with Aaron Lowry, author of Broke Millennial, and Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Life Together, taking your situations about money and what you're dealing with right now. Do you have loans? Do you have credit cards? Do you have a bill that you're not clear where you should go next with it? How is your family budgeting during the pandemic, and are you able to invest at all? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, Aaron, this is still a pretty tight economy for people buying and selling homes. We've seen also the Federal Reserve announcing it will allow for inflation to run hotter than normal to help the economy bounce back. So if we are in the market for a mortgage loan, how do you go about shopping around?
Well, that definitely comes down to making sure you price comparison at different lenders. I also would consider looking at credit unions as well, particularly if you are currently a customer at a credit union, and seeing if you can get a deal there. And you want to do that in really a 14 to 30 day window in order to make sure it's the minimum impact on your credit score. So you want to shop around, price comparison, see where you can get the best deal before you pick who your mortgage lender is going to be.
And so would you suggest taking out a loan at this time? Or if you feel like you are one of those unicorns in the situation where you're feeling pretty stable, can you take a risk right now?
You know, the risk-taking conversation is always a little bit of a hard one because it doesn't take much for things to go sideways. So for people who have been already considering buying a home or have already saved up their down payment and are in a strong situation, certainly it's a hot housing market right now. I believe it's more of a seller's market, but it does depend on where you live. So you certainly can lock in that low mortgage rate now or perhaps refinance. However, I would really think through all of the different scenarios if you're going to make a large-scale financial decision at the moment, and think how easy it is to undo if it's necessary. So buying a car is very different than buying a house, for instance. A house, it's a usually a much larger cost and could take longer to sell if you needed to sell it. With a car, you're going to take a little bit of a loss if you sell it quickly, but at least it's probably easier to undo that option. And really thinking through, if everything went sideways, how much do I have in cash reserves as well to sustain?
Yeah. And, you know, at the federal level, too, we've seen the moratorium come down on evictions. If you're in a situation where you're perhaps faced with a mortgage payment you can't pay, of course, you want to talk with the lenders. But if you are in a situation where you're looking to downsize, sell and try to find less expensive housing, how would you suggest, you know, taking that course?
It's always a great idea to cut housing costs if that's an option for you, especially in tough financial times. Housing tends to be one of our absolutely largest line items in our budget. So if there's any option for you to minimize that expense for yourself, that's a great idea. And for some people, that's going to mean selling their homes and downsizing. For some people, it could even mean bringing on roommates or having some other way to subsidize housing costs, and in order to just give you a little bit more flexibility in your budget.
Are there any tips that you might have to save on fees for, you know, paying the realtor, or, you know, fees that come up in the process of buying and selling a home?
That's such a great process, or such a great question, because that process can be so riddled with so many unexpected fees. So really, one of the first things to do is do a deep dive, do some great research about what are those unexpected fees you might be facing, and really understand how much you're going to be paying, because it's not just the 20% down. The other thing I always like to advise is having really an emergency fund for your house. What happens if you move in and then the water heater breaks a month later? Do you have the extra cash flow to cover that? I would have very honest conversations with people that you know in your life who have recently purchased a home and maybe have a really good handle on these fees. I would have an honest conversation with any realtor you're interested in working with. And I'd look at some great resources. There are so many options out there for looking at buying a house. One of my personal favorites is a site called Bigger Pockets. So just making sure you do a deep dive on how much you think it's going to cost you.
It's interesting they say it's not just about saving up for a big down payment, and you're suggesting that, you know, 20% down, but also having this other whole bucket of money for all the things that just may not work in the house and didn't come up during the home buying process, didn't come up during the inspection.
Absolutely. And I know 20% down sounds like a lot, and there are, especially first time home buyers, you don't necessarily have to have that much. But also looking into, as we go into a recession, what is the bare minimum that's acceptable? Because 3% down might not work anymore, because sometimes they tighten up regulations and requirements as we move into a tighter financial situation as an economy. So you might need 5%, you might need 10%. So making sure that you have that information as well, and don't just assume it was that 3% that your best friend got 2 years ago when we were in a different economy.
Are there still incentives out there for first-time home buyers? Are there still programs?
There are still incentives. There are still programs. So make sure to do your research and also see what's local to your area. There are some that aren't just necessarily federal programs, but there could be ones that are very specific to your county or to your community to try to get people to move into different neighborhoods, different areas. So be sure that you do research as well as what's available very locally.
You know, these times it's really difficult to have those heart-to-heart conversations with the other person who's sharing the budget. If you're in a relationship right now and you're in some difficult emergency times here, how would you suggest you talk about money?
Oh, I love the how to talk about money conversation. And for so many of us, it can be a very stressful, very anxiety-riddled conversation. So the first thing to do is just know that it's coming. I always advise that people set money meetings with each other and they warn the other person that it's coming. You don't just flippantly start asking questions or start kind of badgering your partner. Say, hey, I think it's really important for us to have a money meeting. How about we sit down this Saturday at 10 a.m. to have a conversation? I also like the idea of temptation bundling, where you put a fun activity with it if this is something both of you aren't looking forward to. So maybe it's you have a nice dinner, you order from your favorite takeout place. Maybe it's you open a bottle of wine or get your favorite craft brew, whatever it is that makes you feel good about it. That can be another thing to tie in.
I like it. It's kind of put a carrot out there, like, okay, if we have this conversation, we'll be able to get this.
Absolutely. I think about it as if I'm on that treadmill, I want to be watching one of my favorite trashy TV shows in tandem.
We are tackling money and debt this hour with personal finance author Erin Lowry as our guide. Are you concerned about foreclosure on your home? Are you attempting to downsize or sell right now in this market? What are you seeing out there? Maybe you're a parent trying to help a young adult through these times. What financial help can you give? And what do you tell those young people? What happens as you help a family member and then you get laid off or furloughed yourself? Join in with your situation, working through it, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Erin Lowry, maybe hear from you right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're tackling personal finance issues in the midst of the greatest health and economic crises in generations. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The Trump administration is ordering a stop on evictions through the end of the year, protecting renters from losing their homes during the pandemic. And the move is to head off a wave of looming evictions of people who have lost jobs or sustained a major financial blow due to COVID. Are you worried about keeping up with rent or making your monthly mortgage in these times? What tips can you offer to other renters, other homeowners? It is 800-642-1234 to bring your situation. Erin Lowry is our guide. She's a personal finance author of Broke Millennial. Erin, you were talking earlier about variable interest rates, and I'm wondering, what are variable interest rates tied to? How do they work?
So variable interest rates are the difference between fixed and variable. Is fixed stays the same throughout the life of your loan, while with variable, they're going to fluctuate throughout the life of your loan. Typically, they're fairly low early on and then have the possibility to balloon up. In some cases, people will think, oh, okay, I'll lock in a variable rate now, and then I'll refinance this loan before it jumps too high. But we don't necessarily know what the landscape is going to look like when you plan to do that, or how easy it's going to be for you to do that when the time comes. So if you're able to pay off a loan quickly and lock in a super low rate with variable, it can work out well, but sometimes it can be a little bit of a dangerous game.
Is there a cap on these loans?
Yes, but I'll be honest, off the top of my head, I can't tell you what that is.
Do you think that we should be, are these loans have more risk than fixed, or are they something that we should look more closely at because they may offer some advantages?
They certainly do offer advantages, but I would say it's a financial product that offers an advantage for a very niche group of people. And those are those folks who are generally high income earners and very stable jobs who have the ability to aggressively repay the loan in a short period of time. A really good example could actually be student loan refinancing. When you think about people who want to refinance private student loans that might be at a 6-7% interest rate, and they can refinance to a variable loan that's maybe at 2-3%, and that could save them a lot of money over the life of the loan. But perhaps that they're going to refinance that and then pay off that loan in 2 or 3 years before the interest rate jumps. And not everybody has the financial flexibility and freedom to aggressively pay off debt quite on that scale. So it's something you need to be super honest with yourself before you make that move.
Yeah, and super honest before you make that move, you might be making it with someone else. So this might come up at the money meeting, the family money meeting. Can you sit us down at the kitchen table and walk us through one of these money meetings?
I would love to. I would say the first thing too is even before you get to the kitchen table, you set the time, you set the date, you tell your partner you want to be having this financial conversation, and you both need to think about what you want to discuss. Now, if this is the very first time ever you're having this financial conversation, then you might have some things that you don't necessarily want to reveal right away, but eventually you need to reach what I like to call full frontal financial nudity. And that means you share absolutely everything. Debt, credit scores, income, savings goals, investing, all of it.
Okay.
Now,
So
when you're getting to this table, when you're ready to have the conversation, there's a couple of things you need to figure out. One is how to
we're
initiate.
shivering here.
Well, you need to figure out first how to initiate it. And some of that's going to depend on your partner. There's two ways that I like to recommend. One is just kind of acknowledging the potential awkwardness or tension and breaking the ice and say, listen, I know this is a conversation that can be a little uncomfortable, but it's really important to have how do you feel? And just acknowledging your feelings off the bat. Or the slightly sneakier route that's actually my personal favorite is you ask your partner, what's a goal that you want to achieve in the next 5 years? And they tell you what that is, and you say, okay, and what do you think is standing in our way or your way? And that's also a great way to bring up the debt conversation without actually saying the D word. It puts you on the same page.
What happens when one person has a whole lot more debt than the other person?
And can be really common. The first thing I will tell you is practice your poker face before you enter this conversation because it is really important that you don't actually express anything on your face. And I have a problem with this where I'm very facially expressive. So you've got to remember to hold your expression, don't betray anything because you don't want your partner to feel judged or belittled. You don't want to scoff, you don't want to laugh, nothing like that. Because, and to make it a really more, you know, if you were to get physically naked in front of another human being and they laughed at you, you're not going to do that again. This is a very vulnerable situation to bury yourself financially. So you want to make sure that you're protecting your partner and you're being caring and compassionate. And if they made a mistake a couple of years ago or even last month, that doesn't necessarily mean that that behavior is going to continue on forever. So the red flags, quote unquote, that you want to be looking for is whether or not behavior has changed, not if they screwed up one time in their financial life. So you want to ready that poker face. And if your partner has a lot more debt than you do, again, that doesn't necessarily have to be a deal breaker, but it needs to be a conversation about how would we want to tackle this together? And where did this debt come from? Has the behavior that created that debt, if it was more of a compulsive shopping type debt, change? Or was this because there was a medical issue? Or is this because it was student loans? They're very different types of debt and reasons people amass it.
Okay, so what if you've merged your financial lives? Maybe you're married. What happens with your credit score? One person has a very high credit score, one person might have average credit score. How does that work?
Well, first of all, it's always important to remind folks that your credit scores and your credit profiles don't merge simply
Okay.
because you got married. You still have independent credit histories, independent credit scores. Now, they can impact each other if you have joint accounts. And if you have an account that's reporting on your credit report and perhaps your partner abuses a credit card or doesn't make a payment on a loan, that's when the impacting can happen. But you don't create one credit profile as a married couple. Now, if one person has a stronger credit score than the other and you're looking to make a big financial move, like let's say getting an auto loan or getting a mortgage, you might want to have a conversation about whether that mortgage or that auto loan should just be in the name of the person with the stronger credit score to begin with. You can always put names on deeds or names on loans after the fact, but when it comes for securing the best interest rate, that's a conversation you might want to have. You also can look at why the other person might not have as high of a credit score and see what can be done to rehabilitate that score. Perhaps it's getting them as an authorized user on the credit card of the person with the stronger score so they can kind of ride your coattails to that better score. It could be about lowering your overall debt to income ratio and the utilization that you have on your credit card, which is just a fancy way of saying how much of your credit limit do you use in a month. The higher amount of credit limit you use, even if you pay it off on time and in full, the damage it can do to your credit score. Ideally, you want to use no more than 30% of your available credit limit on your credit card each month, and you always want to pay it off on time and in full.
We are diving into money meetings, credit cards, debt, how to talk with loved ones about finances. Our guide is personal finance expert and author Erin Lowry. Have you had a money meeting before with a loved one? What was the outcome? Are you on the same page about how to spend money and how to save? Join in with your insights, what you've learned over the decades as a couple, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Erin, you know, in this full reveal here, I will say that I'm one in the relationship who likes to pay a bill immediately when it comes. I mean, if it comes, like, I have the opportunity to pay it, I'm just going to pay it. And, you know, my spouse is always like, yeah, just pay it when it's due. It bothers me. So I decided to take over those finances and just pay the bills, right? Because, you know, being in that situation. So what happens if you have a different approach to how you go about bill paying?
It is so common, and I very much relate and empathize with your feelings on paying bills.
Thank you.
But the thing, too, to remember is it doesn't mean that your spouse's way is wrong. It's just different. As long as bills are being paid on time, you're both right. So the thing that you want to do is just what causes the least amount of pain for both parties and what do people want to take ownership of? I think that this is also where it can get in kind of micromanaging territory for people like myself who have type A, like to have a lot of control. There needs to be a conversation about who handles what and make sure that it actually makes the most sense for how the two of you function as a couple. And it's not something you're doing just to like try to teach the other person a lesson. You want to make sure that like, hey, if I'm the chief financial officer of my household, that's entirely okay. It is okay that I handle most, if not all, of the financial day-to-day choices and decisions, but the other person still needs to know everything. And I say that because it's very common in couples for one person to operate as the CFO of the family. But if something happens to that person, and it could be as extreme as death, or it could be that perhaps they get sick and need to stay in the hospital for an extended period of time, or just are on a long trip, and the other person doesn't know how to pay a bill, that's a problem. So you want to make sure that both parties know how to make all the payments, log into all the accounts, and handle absolutely everything, just in case something ever happens to the CFO.
Right. I was just thinking about all the passwords, all the accounts,
yes,
just the things that flow in. And if it's only one person and the other person really hasn't done it for months, maybe years, that could be a real issue.
It could. And part of that could be automating. And that makes it a lot easier is if you have bills that are automated to accounts, especially in kind of the transitional period, if you will. But also looking at whether it's technological solutions like websites that are password keepers to make it easier to log in, or if you have like a dossier of all this information that you keep in a locked box or a safe somewhere, there just needs to be a protocol in place if something happens. The other thing is you both still need to have open communication about money and have a lot of conversations about goal setting and how you are doing on achieving those goals. And I tie that back to the money meeting. Even if one person handles most of the financial moves and decisions and payments, you want to have conversations on a regular basis with each other so that both parties know.
Personal finance expert Erin Lowry is with us. Still time to talk about your financial situation. What are your tips for building up an emergency fund, for having a money meeting? What has worked for your family over the years? How much of your earnings are you trying to set aside? How much is right to save versus leave for expenses? And what happens if you get furloughed or laid off? Still time to talk these things through. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Erin Lowry here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with personal finance expert and author Erin Lowry. We've been talking about these difficult financial times with tens of millions of people out of work, countless businesses struggling, and we've been discussing family finances, the meeting, the managing living expenses, paying for school, negotiating with creditors. Let's bring in Tom now, joining us from Cedarburg. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Well, you know, I keep hearing these advertisements that talk about your title for your home being on the internet, and that people could forge your name somehow and get loans on your home title, and that you could lose your home because of that. And I was wondering if there's any truth to that, and if so, what do I need to do to protect my home title?
Not home title lock ads, Aaron. Have you seen those?
I'll be honest, I have not, and I am now going to do a deep dive on this. I would say that I'm sure there's a kernel of truth, just like there's a kernel of truth in a lot of things, but whether or not you need to pay a company an exorbitant fee potentially in order to protect yourself, I would question. I would actually try to discuss with either a mortgage broker or a realtor or anybody like that to see how much validity there is to the ease at which people could actually get access. But I would also just look up home title lock scam and Google and see what comes up.
Tom, thanks. Let's bring in Steve now in Fitchburg. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say this is a great segment. I really like the idea of spouses or partners talking to each other about their finances and especially their debt. I just wanted to say I really agree with it. I used to work for a government agency that collected debt, and it was amazing to me when I talked to a partner that had absolutely no idea that they owed debt, and in some cases their wages or bank accounts would actually be attached.
And they would be garnished?
Correct.
Yeah.
And then they would, they actually did not even know they owed debt. So there is a little bit of trust but verify sometimes. And in those situations, the partner would be intercepting all the mail. So the other one didn't even know they owed something.
Steve, thanks for bringing this up. Aaron, what about that in trying to dig deeper into what the financial situation of that partner is?
It's such a great point and really common. That's what I would qualify as financial infidelity. When you are withholding that kind of financial information from a spouse and lying, especially about debt that's being accumulated in the marriage, because there is a very strong possibility your partner could be liable for that debt. So one of the things that you can do as the partner, especially if you think something might be happening and they're not being completely honest, is to also just ask to share credit reports. And to you are able once per year normally. Right now you actually can get a little bit more access to get a copy of your credit report from each of the three bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. And the other thing you can do is if your partner has taken on any debt in your name or if you are liable for it, it should be getting reported on your credit report as well. So if there's debt on there that you didn't know existed, that's going to be the first red flag. It's either fraud or something's happening with your spouse. And I would also just perhaps bring in a neutral third party, whether it is a marriage counselor or a financial advisor or someone else to help you navigate this conversation. But for some people, financial infidelity could be cause for divorce. Now, I'm not saying you should get divorced if it happens, but I'm saying it can get to that extreme because it's a breach of trust.
Well, in the last moments we have, I would like to hear your thoughts on temptation bundling. As we had talked earlier about money meetings, what can we do with our partner to celebrate our ability to make a budget and work together?
Well, I love the idea of celebrating your big and little wins along the way. And it doesn't always have to be a celebration that includes spending money. It could be doing a beloved activity together, perhaps even ones that are free, or kind of indulging a little bit financially. Maybe you set aside $20 each month while you're working towards a big goal so that you can go out to a nice meal, or you can do something that you really love together when you hit that milestone. And, you know, in the short term, just anything that the two of you enjoy that makes it feel fun. Maybe it's that you save watching a television show you're watching together for after you have the meeting. Mm. Or like I said earlier, it's opening up a bottle of wine that you both like to share, ordering from your favorite takeout place, as long as that's not busting your budget, or making a favorite meal. Just anything that kind of combines something that brings pleasure with something that might not be your favorite thing to do on an evening.
Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. And I hope everyone gets to the point where you do enjoy having these money talks, but I know it can take time.
Aaron Lowry is a personal finance expert and author. Her next book is out in December. It's called Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look at an historic building that will soon be torn down.
The Sheboygan Armory has overlooked Lake Michigan for nearly 80 years. The Art Deco building that once housed an NBA team and welcomed world-famous performers like Bob Hope has a special place in the hearts of many Sheboyganites, but doesn't have much time left. Megan Hart brings us a look back on the history of the Sheboygan Armory.
The atmosphere at the Sheboygan Armory was electric during legendary North-South high school basketball games. Sherry Becker says students used to shake the benches so violently, she's surprised they didn't rip from the walls.
Games at the Armory were just absolutely fantastic and very memorable.
Becker was a senior at Sheboygan North High School in 1987. She had enough credits to finish classes early, so friends at South asked their teacher if she could join them for gym class. They learned a dance routine to perform at the North-South rivalry game at the Armory. Becker sat with her classmates from North and excused herself to the bathroom just before halftime. Little did her friends know she was about to cheer for the other team.
At the end of our routine, we spelled out South on the floor, so I made sure I was on top of the H so I could turn around and wave to all my friends. And I did. It was so much fun. I turned around and they just started yelling, "Traitor! Traitor!"
Like many Sheboyganites, Becker has lots of good memories from the Armory. She used to work setting up professional wrestling rings around Wisconsin, including at the Armory. As a teenager, Becker snuck out to see the band Rat perform there. But now she says she's too sad to drive by the building. They're clearing it out before tearing it down. The Sheboygan Armory was completed in 1942 as one of the last projects of the Works Progress Administration, the federal stimulus program aimed at lifting the U.S. from the Great Depression through widespread employment. Beth Dipple is executive director of the Sheboygan County Historical Research Center. She says unskilled workers were paid 40 cents an hour to finish the building.
But, when you weren't making anything, it was enough to put food on the table.
The whole building cost about $240,000 to complete, despite its elaborate design.
You know, it's basically poured concrete, and they designed it so that in layers, the more people that could be employed, the better.
The Armory was built to house a division of the National Guard and Sheboygan's professional basketball team. It was one of the NBA's original arenas. It went on to host acts like Alice Cooper and Sheboygan's own Cordettes. Plus other community events like school dances, coin shows, and blood drives.
Probably 25 years, it was full almost every weekend and an awful lot of time during the week. And then everybody else after that point in time started to build their own facilities.
Today, North and South high schools have their own gyms. The city began to contemplate the building's future years ago. Officials say the Armory was expensive to maintain and challenging to renovate. A space museum moved in briefly. A high school shop teacher considered working on it with his class. And a former NBA player even tried to make the Armory home to the Wisconsin Herd, the G League affiliate of the Milwaukee Bucks. Dipple says a lot of community members stepped up.
Anything and everything was tried. I mean, it was valiant efforts to try and figure out an adaptive reuse for this wonderful building. But it just didn't work.
The Armory's time has come. Now the Sheboygan County Historical Museum is focused on preserving its memory for the sake of future generations.
Over here, we have items. So they did put a time capsule.
Executive Director Travis Gross grew up in Sheboygan.
You know, I have to say, go north. I just have to say it.
He went to holiday fairs and watched the Harlem Globetrotters at the Armory. But some of his favorite moments there took place in the last 6 months after its fate was sealed.
Because this is a story that's coming to an end. And to be able to get in there and, you know, walk around, see all the rooms, nooks and crannies, you know, see those seats and go, that's where I sat for that concert, you know, that kind of thing. It's all very personal.
WPR's Megan Hart brought us the story on the Sheboygan Armory, an historic building that's scheduled to be torn down next year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Ideas Network.